Welcome to the Smoking Word.
It's always brought to you by CasaTheRock.com. That's my merch store. If you want to support the show, that's where you go. We still got some NYHC slides available. Go there for slides. We got t-shirts. We got snapbacks. We got a lot of shit. All t-shirts are $21 for 2021 because that's how we're doing it. And also, thank you to everybody who's been copping that merch. CasaTheRock.com. We also got, so we got some slides left and we're about to drop some new merchandise on there also. So look out for that. And also, we got some shows coming up with Gwar. When you hear this, I think the week after the shows will be going on. So I don't got the dates again in front of me, but you got Google for that. But we got some shows with Gwar and I Hate God. Go check us out then. And then after that, we're going to Cali. And we got that punk rock bowling in Vegas. So I want to see everybody out there. Thank you to everybody who's been coming out to all our shows and who will be continue to come out to all our shows. Because wherever they want us, we're going to be there to play. So look out for us in a fucking city near you. What else? Follow us, CasaTheRock.com. You could also follow us on Instagram. The Smoking Word podcast has an Instagram. So if you have any questions about the Smoking Word, go to Smoking Word on Instagram. You can also follow me at HoyaRock357 on Instagram. And a big, big shout out to always to my Patreon family who've been holding me down. I know we had a little bit of a break there. I said that on the last one. But if you saw that we just dropped a half hour. If everybody who's out there, if you're listening to this, only my Patreon family seen what we got. I got some really good exclusive shit unseen to the public eye. So if you want to get down with the get down, patreon.com/thesmokingword. That's how you invest in the show. If you want the Smoking Word to keep going on, if you want to keep killing time with your boy, that's where you go support the show. You know the deal. There's four tiers. You can support from $2 up, exclusive footage, and I'm going to be taking it on the road. So if you're part of the Patreon family, you're going to have a lot of exclusive backstage shit going on. I can't tell you what it's going to be because it hasn't happened yet, but stay tuned. Shout out to my Patreon family and definitely who else? A big shout out to the Hella Hot Sauce family for keeping me fucking right with the hot sauce and the Cali Care Group. Listen, keep your brains right out there. Get that sun. Medicate naturally. Eat fruit. Eat things that are green. Do things that are green. You know the deal. And I want to say a big shout out to Samsa, Louis Rodriguez, Corey, and Hold It Down's finest, Darren Morgenthaler. Darren, remember, your last name sounds like a fucking death metal band. I always remember you said that, but shout out to everybody. Shout out to Rick the Straps for lacing us. Kai and my brother Warren. I got the flyest straps in the game. So all you guitarists, bass players out there, go get those Rick the Straps. And also to Cortex, my family in Kreuzberg, Germany. Thank you for the package. Go support them. They are the fucking home base in Europe for fucking everything hardcore. So, you know, go check them out. All right. I got on this episode of The Smoking Word, I finally got my boy, Boston's finest, the one and only, my brother Slain. Let's set this shit off. We should have threw that gangsta shit. Oh shit. You see, just as I said that, boom. You hear me?
That's good. I didn't hear you. What'd you say?
There you go. No, I was just about to say, yo, throw that Gangstar shit on and pop, you popped up. I said, you know, it said George Carroll, but then I had to bring you out of the darkness. What up? What's going on?
Chilling, man.
Hell yeah. No, I'm glad I fucking finally got you. I was saying it, but we've been talking about it for a while. And I was like, yo, the little gap came on. I said, let me jump on it. You know, like, you know how that shit works.
I was like, we talked about it a few times. You've been doing this podcast a minute, right?
Yeah, like, you know what it is? I had the shit like 5-6 years ago, the first round of it. And then we stopped. And then, you know, it was hard to keep up because technology, that shit wasn't up. It ain't like now with the Zoom shit and all that. Yeah. You know, it was like I needed my sound man to literally do the shit for me. You know, I'm like, you know, I can't do shit. I barely know how to use my phone. You know, I'm like, I turned into my pops. You know what I mean? Like, and fucking, but then what happened was during the COVID shit, I started seeing like the Zoom shit come into play, you know, on interviews and whatever. And I go, what's this Zoom shit? And I'm like, everybody was getting it. And I go, wait a minute. It just made this platform way easier to do.
I need a microphone like you. Can you hear me all right?
Yeah, you sound good. I got you.
Right, dope.
You know, nah, yeah, exactly. And fucking basically it made, you know, this shit happen like this. And it's like, that's the one good thing that came out of this COVID shit. You know, it was like this part of technology, it kept the world connected. You know what I mean? And that shit's important.
Evolved, bro. I mean, this is just part of the whole thing, how everything works now. You can jump on Zoom for better or worse. It's the gift and the curse, you know?
But exactly. And what's up with you? Like, I know what you've been doing, but what you've been doing?
I've been chilling, man. You know, I think this whole thing put the whole world on pause. You know what I'm saying? For a minute. And then we kind of navigate around it. It's like anything in life, right? You get hit with the obstacle. It stuns you for a second, and then you change and you adapt and you make things work. So, I mean, I've been doing the same shit minus the touring, you know what I'm saying? But, I've been recording. I got a new movie coming out. And, you know, I told you on the phone the other day, I've been, you know, working in addiction and recovery. And
Yeah. No, we're going to talk about that because this whole shit leads into that, basically. But fucking go back during the beginning of this shit. Did you have anything ready that you were going to drop or something set up? What were you playing before COVID?
I had like 30 shows that I was about to announce. I mean, yeah, I had already announced some. I had a St. Paddy's Day show.
Of course, always
right
remember.
It was my 14th consecutive St. Paddy's Day show in Boston. And right up to the day before it, I was like, the show's still on. And then the governor announced no gatherings of 10 people. I was like, oh, that's it.
Yeah.
And it happened. So it didn't happen. And then I had to cancel a bunch of shows after that. And I was like, oh, fuck. Because, you know, I'm an independent artist, man. So, I mean, touring is part of how I survive and feed my family and all that. You know what I'm saying? So that sent a little shock through me for a minute. But I was like, all right, well, let me just capitalize on the time to stay home with my family and all that. And, you know, found a way to record through it too. Like I was doing mixing sessions with the Archetype, who's, you know, my business partner, my producer. Like we, you know, I put my music out through his label now. And
yeah,
you know, we work together on everything. So, I mean, we have a whole thing set up now too for like, you know, we can actually get on the same file together and listen to, you know, like mix a song together. Like,
it's crazy. You know what? What we're doing now is what Rick Rubin used to get paid mad loot for back in the day when he would produce sessions from his house. You remember people used to be like, yo, he pops on a screen and he just listens to the sessions. Oh, you mean what we do all the time now? But that's what he used to do for some sessions. He wasn't even in the house. But he could have been, but
it's,
you know,
crazy how technology just goes like that. Because you remember when we were growing up, this shit was impossible. It was like Inspector Gadget and
hell yeah,
and that TV show Get Smart, right?
So hell, it's
like,
yeah,
you could look at people on the watch or fucking on a TV monitor or whatever, and it's like that shit didn't even exist. And then when it did exist, it just happened.
Listen, I could tell you, I could tell you when it happened for me in technology for recording. I forgot which record, but we're recording. It's our first record with Pro Tools. This is why you could understand this. So, you know, obviously we come from the old days of doing shit on reels. So everybody listening to this, we're going to talk some tech shit, but you're getting this from a gorilla. So it ain't going to be too technical. But this, we came up recording the old way onto tape. Now, the Pro Tools talk was only Metallica, Madonna, you used to hear about, you know, the big dogs, you know, sessions like that. And back then, Pro Tools was taboo. Oh, it's not going to make the song sound natural. The sessions are going to sound fake, blah, blah, blah. So, you know, I came up that way and I don't know shit. I just know I like what I like. I play what I play. And then we go to record the record. So they were like, yo, we're going to do this shit on Pro Tools. And we have all these questions and all these questions that are probably such bullshit questions now looking back. And we're telling Zeus. I think it was Zeus. And then he's like, all right, go through the song. So, you know, we go through the song. He goes, okay. And we're like, what do you mean, okay? He's like, no, we got that take. You want to do one more? And I go, no. What do you mean? We got the take already. He goes, yeah, there's like one mistake. We'll go one more pass. And then I got enough. I go, what do you mean you got enough? Because we're used to tracking a song fucking 100 times just because on tape, you know how it was. We recorded no click tracks for our music back then. No clicks. We're going on feel that you can see. It's fucking, and now I'm like, we couldn't believe it. Me and Mitz were like, no, we're going to do extra takes just because we want to do them. Yeah. You know, and he was like, all right, if you want to do what you want, but we got
it. Yeah, I remember recording on the ADAT, onto ADAT. And then like, I remember a specific track I did and it had like a beep on it at a certain point. I was like, oh, fuck. You know, well, I'm going to fix that. But it's like, you can't just, now in Pro Tools, it's just like, highlight it, delete it. You know what I'm saying? You can move. Yeah. It's just so much easier and more cost effective, really. I think that's obviously why everybody moved to that, because who got time and money to like fucking, you know, for all the extra shit.
Yeah, but your first ever recording anything, was it at a real studio or was it like with a box pressing record?
It was the first time the first
yeah, first.
Ever recording anything. I would go to Tower Records. I would get like instrumental tapes that had the instrumental, like a maxi single that had the instrumental. And I would buy blank tapes and I would put the instrumental in the one deck and the blank tape in the other deck and the record deck. And I would plug the headphones into the jack and it would act like a microphone. Then I would take the blank tape out and put it in the play deck, and I would put another blank tape into the other deck. Meanwhile, I'm losing quality every time I go down, but
yeah,
I would do the track. And that's how I practiced and before I ever went into a studio.
Hell yeah. And that's why I asked, because I did the same shit. And I want people to understand that, like, again, I like bringing this up once in a while, with all types of music, like, it's dope technology and laptops now and all this shit, but you don't need none of that shit. You just got to want to do it and you'll figure out how to fucking do it. Cause what that's I used new. To, you know, I used to do the same. What I had to do was I would play a track on a tape. Right. And then I would play it. I would play a hip hop video. Right. And then I would play that guitar track. I would play the guitar track on a radio, hit the video, sync that up, and then press record on another tape and then play the live track to do this. I was doing the same shit, like, you know, Ray, it was insane just to hear an overdub, to hear a fucking, you know, a punch, you know what I mean?
And I'm like, that's part of how you develop your style and find your voice and everything, because, you know, the first time you do it, you're like, damn, that's how I sound.
Yeah.
And then you're holding your shit for years and years and years. That's why I almost feel bad for some of these kids now who put the first shit they ever recorded like onto the internet for everybody to hear. Nobody heard my shit until I had been doing it for 15 fucking years. You know what I'm saying? Like, I had already like found a rhythm and found my voice and mastered it to a certain extent. You know what I'm saying? But
yeah,
I tell dudes like, I wouldn't put that out yet. That's the first.
Yeah. You know, I think that's what also, I mean, it sucks in some ways. It's dope in some ways and it sucks in some ways because it keeps the magic, like, you know, you hear stories like, how was he? I heard he back in the day, he was dead. Nobody knows. But in some ways, if you're dope, even nobody starts off dope. But, you know, sometimes you can see that diamond in the rough. If you could see that shit unfold, it'd be dope to see that, you know, like, oh, shit. Like, I see him progression, you know, from a SoundCloud kid or something. And then be like, OK, yo, now I see him on a single. OK, now I see him on a guest track. Oh, shit. Now the kid's dope. He's on a Sprite commercial.
Yeah,
you know, all right, that could be cool, but
nobody
like,
wants to see that shit until you're already dope, and then like, oh, I can see how it evolved, like in the beginning.
I know. hip hop or rap, how long now you say, okay, you've been rapping all the time, but like, yo, okay, I'm rapping, I'm going for it. Like, how many years you give yourself?
I mean, this is just part of who I am. Like, I do it regardless of whether I'm torn, whether I'm making money, whatever.
Because when I met you, when you were coming, when LD coming to New York and all that around that time, 18. You know, you already had that shit where you were like, okay, yeah, I'm trying to, you know, I want to get put on. I'm trying to find who's doing what. You were going to whatever.
Yeah, I was 18 years old. I met you when I was 18 years old. Yeah. Yeah. I was making demo tapes with Damian.
Yeah, that's what I mean.
You know what I'm saying?
But already then, you were already saying, okay, you know, I want to try to get signed, blah, blah, blah. When were you saying, yeah, I want to start getting signed? How far rap? Because you were always, because, you know, a lot of city kids, like the same thing with me. I grew up rapping for fun. You know how it is. Everybody was always just rapping, being around, and you grow up rapping for fun. And then blah, blah, blah. And then I grew up with dudes that would do the same. We would do it for fun. Even MQ being around bombing, you know, you start freestyling, talking shit. And then I remember then there was dudes that, oh, they would write and then take the next level. They start doing demos.
Yeah.
Okay. I wouldn't. Then I was just like, oh, no, I like it. You know, I changed the words off whatever song was on the radio a little bit. Now, then I saw these other guys taking it further. They were, okay, taking it serious then. How far into rapping you think before you said, okay, let me.
So my shit was a little bit different because I started writing when I was 9 years old. And, you know, I would just kind of bite like whatever I was listening to at the time, whether it was LL Cool J or Beastie Boys or, you know, Big Daddy Kane. I would try to do it like Big Daddy Kane did it. And then as I got older, when I was like 15 or 16, then I started to find a little more of my own. I was writing like stuff that I was going through, but I always kept it secret. I wasn't out like freestyling and shit like that when I was that age. It wasn't like, it was a different kind of culture in Boston where everything was kind of segregated. And, you know, there was still like a lot of like, you know, it was like, it wasn't like New York.
No, Boston. I know Boston was, you know, all black on one side, all white on one side, even if it was all hip hop, you know what I mean?
Yeah, and so people would look at you like, what are you trying to be? Like, if you're trying to, you know what I'm saying? Like, everybody listen to hip hop, but so I kind of kept it a secret, you know what I'm saying? So I have been writing for years before anybody ever heard it. And then a couple of my friends, whatever, would be like, damn, that's good, dude. But I never really thought it was a possibility to me. And, you know, after high school, like I cleaned up a little because I was heavy into hard drugs, like towards the last couple of years of my high school with the angel dust and all that. And I was fucked up a little bit. And then I got my shit together and then I went to New York. I wanted to go to film school. So I went to film school. That's where I met Damian and Cypher. And then that's when I started going out and freestyling on corners and doing open mic. And that's when I realized like, oh shit, I'm good at this. I got something here. And once I started doing that and catching a little wave with it, then I got kicked out of film school and I was like, all right, fuck it. I just put my chips in with the music shit. And I was having such a good time with it. And that's when, like, you know, we met MC Shan and we were going to the studio in Jamaica, Queens. We were making demo.
So let me ask you that. How was that with Shan and whatever? How did that connection happen? Because, you know, I grew up, you know, being from Queens, I used to hear about, you know, I never seen him. I seen him in a Jeep as a kid, but you know, you used to hear, yo, Shan, but you know, how the hell you connected the dots with him?
I forget how we started going to this dude, Reinhardt's studio in Jamaica, Queens. I think it was Damien's connect. I forget exactly, honestly, now at this point, how we ended up there, but we ended up there and Reinhardt was like, yo, you're dope, bro. Like fucking, you know, like that. He was like, yo, you got to check out this white kid that comes to my studio. And then Shan came through one time and Shan, you know, he schooled me a little bit. He's like, you got to pronounce your words better. He used to have me rap with the pen in my mouth in the booth, like to stretch out. And then I remember he said to me one day, he had on a gold watch. He's like, you want to get a gold watch like this? He's like, stick with me. I'm gonna show you how to do this.
You want a Timex like this? He's like, no, but I'm not like, I mean, that's dope, and that's just dope. That like, let me ask you this. All right, how many was there? A lot. Like you said, it was a secret. Like that, a lot of people didn't know you were writing hip hop or whatever. How many white kids you knew that were rhyming? Like at that time when you were out, because you know, you find each other, you hear about other dudes, you know what I mean?
I think, that was the era where it all started to kind of, you know, prior to that, right? There was the Beastie Boys, then there was House of Pain.
Yeah.
And there was, you know, so, but then I think Eminem came out a little bit after that and really started to blow up. But at the time, there was hundreds of dudes on the underground. You had the like Esoterics, Apathy, Vinnie Paz, of course, Nonfiction. Of course, you know what I'm saying? Like that kind of that the white dudes that were coming up. There was a whole underground, you know, Company Flow, LP from Company Flow.
Yeah, so I remember them.
Those open mics and stuff like that. Those dudes were already putting records out, like that vinyl, Fat Beats, Fondulum, you know what I'm saying? Cage.
Yeah.
All those dudes. So when I was going and doing a freestyling in front of those, like the New Eurekan and stuff, like Ill Bill would be performing inside before I knew it, Bill.
Yeah.
And Necro, and you know what I'm saying? And they had already started like their own labels and fucking and getting on like that. So, you know, I think like I met those dudes a little ways down the line. Like I met Caves from Lords of Brooklyn, and he's the one who put me on. He actually gave me the name Slain, because you remember what everybody used to call me before that, right?
Yeah, John Doe.
Yeah, John Doe. Yeah, I remember. You know what's funny? It's like I'll see people from back in the day in New York, and they'll still be like, John Doe, what up?
Yeah,
what
and you're like, yo, but that ain't a bad name. It's ain't bad.
Now, you know why I had to change it, though, is there was a few dudes coming out. There was somebody who got signed. I think Busta Rhymes managed some guy or signed some dude that named John Doe. There was a couple coming up. There was another dude on Diamond D's tape. So I started to see that name was already, you know what I'm saying?
Yeah. So
And then when I came to the studio one day, I was going to Lords of Brooklyn studio, and Caves had a logo all drawn up and everything. He's like, and he started calling me Slain.
There you go.
Like, okay.
And that's dope. And when you were, and I remember when you were doing when the demos of LD and Damien and Astoria, when you were coming, you have any of those tapes left? Any old demo shit?
I was just asking LD that the other day. I remember those too. You know what's crazy? Because the technology changed, like those tapes, I don't think I have too many of them. I'll bet you Damien got some.
Yeah, he definitely must have some. Yo, some of that shit, you put it in one of those Bitcoin stock R2D2s.
NFTs, right?
NFTs, R2D2s. That's what I was looking for. Exactly. Yo, but that's good shit if you could get them. You know what I mean? Like old demo shit that you don't care about. Then later on, it's like dope to have on catalog, you know, even for yourself.
Yeah.
To be like, I have that. Because you know what's crazy? That you start hearing, like, I heard, like, recently, I heard one of the, like, they put my old band, they had released the old demos, right? And they had these songs that we did at a rehearsal, we recorded them for the 7-inch, but they were just 2-track lives. But I could already hear my style now, like in pieces. Yeah. So it was pretty bugged out to kind of hear, like, oh shit, you know what I mean? Like, little things you do, you know what I mean? When you start finding out certain words, how you like fucking, I like putting this with this. I like, you know, everybody has those little sweet spots they use when they make music, you know, and they're writing.
And it's a whole development process, like I said, and it comes from hearing yourself partly. Yeah. It comes from seeing what works live. I mean, like performing live is such a big piece of it. You know that, especially with hardcore music. I feel like I never even got hardcore music just listening to it in the beginning. LD used to play me shit. And but then when I went and the first show I ever went to was Madball, Agnostic Front, and Murphy's Law. It was in CBGB's. It was like 1996.
That should have reborn anybody. That should have made anybody a believer or run for the fuck.
Because so much of it is how it translates live. I mean, that's the essence of it. And I even noticed that too, like with Spotify and stuff. I feel like the streaming numbers aren't necessarily as high and I noticed like some of the hip hop artists have high streaming numbers, but nobody goes to their shows.
Yeah.
And then you see like hardcore artists, the streaming numbers aren't as big as some of these hip hop artists, but their shows are packed.
Yeah.
It's an experience. You know what I'm saying?
It's so weird how that whole draw shit works. You know, I seen it. It's weird what hardcore and metal. And I seen it with hip hop a lot also because my brother would do rest in peace. My brother was doing security at one of these clubs in the city, fucking the one Narc works at. Anyway, fucking I would hear about different acts and also Irving, you know, you hear Ice Cube plays, and then you hear it's like all right, it was a decent draw. And you're like, okay, it should be bigger. He's a movie star, but I get it. He's not in the mix. And then you hear, all right, yo, EPMD played. And I'm like, yo, that's Long Island. You know, that's OG shit. Yo, we dope. 10 people there. Then my brother, this was before the dude blew up. But my brother goes one time, he goes, yo, yeah, I almost got into beef with these dudes. I had to check these dudes. I'll never forget it. He goes, I had to check these white boys. I go, what happened? He goes, yeah, there was some fat dude with a beard, whatever. But yo, he brought like 250 people. Yeah, some shit, Action Bronson. And I remember laughing because I was like, fuck you, nigga. You making that shit up? Because I never heard of that name at the time. This was before he came out, kind of. You know what I mean? Like, I was still kind of like, and my brother goes, but he brought 250 people. But yet, EPMD wasn't drawing that. You know, it's so weird how that shit works. And now even crazier.
Well, even market to market too, man. Like New York is really, New York is a tough market to draw in because
even for us.
You would think it's easier because there's so many people. But the thing is, like, you could be playing a show here, but then down the street, Nas is playing. And then up the street, Action Bronze playing. Yeah. Action Bronson is playing. And then, you know, over there, I mean, there's so much that you're competing with. There's nightclubs. There's everything, all the nightlife that you're competing with anytime you do a show in New York. So, I mean, every city has its own element to it too. And then you see some of these new jack kids who you don't even know who the fuck they are, and they'll draw like 3,600 people. You're like, who the fuck is this?
It's crazy. You know? It's crazy. But then
they're here today and gone tomorrow.
Crazy, you know, crazy. And you know what? Something I wanted to talk about. It just popped in my head when he said the new kids, and it's something that I know. I was gonna talk about with you anyway, because it's something that, you know, you went through and whatever. It was how the drugs of the era affect the music that we play is something that's been in my head with a lot of things. Cause I'm one of these, I got mad theories on music. I'm one of those dudes. I dissect music, trends, theories, and I got theories on everything. Even with hip hop, you know, I'm a hip hop guy. You know what I mean? I love that rap shit, you know, my era and my shit, but whatever, like I'm always, and, it's crazy. So, okay. You know, obviously you have problems with that. Even you just said early on you were smoking. What was the drug of choice early on when you said, okay, I was fucking really wilding now. You were drinking.
In the beginning, it was anything I could get because I was just trying to see what did what. And I liked being out of control and
yeah.
You know what I'm saying and all that. But I think like over time, you know, all the drugs I did, I think alcohol was my number one drug, man, because everything else was just to keep me drinking. So I love doing coke, and I love And then the Xanax was to like take me down, to help me sleep, to stop me from shaking, because I would get, you know, I was drinking 2/5 a day for the last 10 years of my drinking, so I would need to take Xanax just to stop my hands from shaking and stuff when I woke up. But I think like I think the key to music, right? Like, is you just got to tell the truth. And when you tell the truth in music, ultimately you become a product of your time, whether you know it or not. And you can't even see it in the time that you're writing it. 15 years later, you look back and you can see that all the music is a reflection of everything that's going on at the time, the politics, the economy, the fucking whatever is going on. Right. So when we look back at this time, it's going to reflect everything that's going on right now, whether it's the pandemic and division amongst people and, you know, the ego and the fucking, you know, just the crazy shit that's all going on around us, man. Like the brainwashing and the media, and, you know, that's going to be apparent when we look back at the art of this generation, whether it's film, music, whatever it is. Like, you can't help but do that. Like, it's
you know, it's crazy that exactly kind of what you said is kind of what on the same subject, what I was talking about, like the kids today are now on some, you can hear it in the hip hop. It's fucking sluggish, is mumbling because everybody's on lean. Everybody's on a pill. Everybody's on that. And that, and you know what? That really dumbed down people where. Now people are, it's just easier to be taken advantage of. This is without being political, just being as, you know, just being to be free in general. And I'm like, that affects the music sonically and also the vibe of everything. Because what's our era? Our era was weed, If it was blow, but they mainly talked about selling it. It was mainly drinking and blazing and hip hop and rock and roll was okay. Maybe do lines and drinking alcohol. All right. And then whatever. Now it's a different game. Now they hear when you talk about coke, now they're like, oh, that's that drug dealer rap. And I'm like, the difference is I heard somebody saying, I go, that's a fucking fact. Back then with hip hop was the drug, like the drug dealer's point of view, or I want to be the guy in power's point of view. Now is, no, I'm a drug user. I ain't a drug dealer. Now you're automatically out the box. You already put yourself a step down. Not that I'm telling people out there to go be drug dealers, but you're already, even in that world, you're putting yourself lower from jump. It already has you dumbed down. It's so crazy, the mentality of, you know.
I think with this era, though, and it's not just the music, it's everything. It's, you know, it's get attention at all costs, right? So it's like shock value shit at the end of the day. Like, you know, and it's a product of the streaming too, right? It's like, here's the crazy part. Like it used to be, you used to have to get people to buy your album. My album is in the store. How do I get people to go to the store and buy my album? Here's how it changed. You make an album, you put it out. It's in everybody in the world's pocket. We all have your album in our pocket. How do I get you to reach into your pocket and listen to my album out of the millions of different things you can listen to? Because you have every album in the world in your fucking pocket right now. So how do you do that? You do it by shock value, a lot of people. You know what I'm saying? Like the Instagram shit, the trolling. I mean, bro, we just had a president that was a troll. Like he was a reality television star. Television has switched. We grew up there with shows, with actors and dramas and family dramas and all that. And now what it is, it's just reality television. It's people who are a disaster. Like it's, let's put all these people in one house who are all different, who are not going to get along and have them drink and get high. And then we'll record what happens and then we'll play it to the world.
But wasn't it always that? I always thought it was that when they wanted the 50 cents, did they want to see the kid come up and they see him self-destruct? But now it seems like now you got it on wax. Now with like exactly like the next step up, like let's make it exactly. It seems like a real life reality show. Like let's, you know, if it's Kodak Black now, if it's whoever now, you're watching these guys come up and then watching them. Let's watch them self-destruct. Yeah, those are all the guys blowing up.
That's right.
It's insane. It's crazy. Yeah, you know,
it's like it's clickbait. Basically, it's like, how can I get you to just stream my shit? How can I get you to pay attention to this shit? And the thing is, though, like you and I both know, that's not a long term plan, man. Like you see this Tekashi 6ix9ine kid, or there's a million kids like him, though. You know what I'm saying? It's that flavor of the month. It's like shock value shit. Everybody, even me, I was following what he's doing, like on Instagram and shit. Like, just because you can't not, it's like a car accident on the side of the road.
Exactly.
And half the people who are following him hate him. They can't stand him, but they can't stop watching. You know what I'm saying? But I think like the longevity of it, I still think, you know, like we have fans that have stayed with us over the course of 20 years. I mean, I have fans that have grown up with me. You know, I have fans that send me messages like, you know, that their whole life changes while mine is changing. You know what I'm saying? And they're invested in the music. And I know Madball is like that too. You have lifelong fans who are invested in the stories, who are invested in the feel of it. They're invested in the culture behind it. They're invested in all of it. And that's authentic. That's like a what do they call it? That's what they call an engaged audience, right? Like when I would rather have an engaged audience of 100,000 people than a passive audience of 10 million
people. Of course. Yeah, you get the attention. You want people to rock, really rock with you. Yeah, of course. You know, that's for sure. But let me ask you this on that whole drug tip, because this is the whole thing where like, to glorify in any way, but I always I bug out and I always try to I like talking about how these vices actually affect the music. How, like for me, I never wrote a song without blazing. Now, not because on some, oh, I'm saying it to say it. It's just a reality. And it's going to be, we're working on a 10th album. it was just something that would let me come up with something and not be so anal on it and just let me jam with it. You know, I get nice. I take a couple blasts, a couple puffs. I'm good. I could relax. I could jam out to something, and I'm not. I'm being very judgmental on myself. When I'm straight, I come up with something. I'm like, it's whack. It's whack, and I won't work nothing out. Now, for a fact, I know that's part of my remedy. And guys that partied, we all know throughout the years and whatever, we know. I know for a fact, good or bad, sometimes bad things help write good music. Yeah. Well, how much of that was with you then? And then we'll talk about how it is now doing it without it.
That was all it was. I mean, that was a big, I mean, there was a lot of aspects to my addiction, but that was definitely a part of it. And it was the hardest thing to overcome because it was my livelihood. And I was like, I can't do this. I relapsed over and over when I tried to stop. And I'm trying to save my house, my marriage, my family. And I can't stop because I got 28 days and I go in the studio and I have writer's block. And it's that thing you said. I'm so critical of everything I do. And when I have a couple drinks, it makes that voice go away. And I'm like, all right. I start questioning everything and I just let it flow.
Yeah.
You know what I'm saying? And that was such a part of my process. Never mind the cocaine. The cocaine helped me do 3 songs a night.
Yeah.
You know what I'm saying? So I'm like, fuck, I'm going till 7 in the morning. Put on another beat. Put on. I'm leaving the studio with 3 joints, man.
And
I think it's the greatest thing ever. And like all these songs are brilliant until I listen the next day. And I'm like, well, that's when I start doing my editing. When I'm like, all right, this one's cool. That one, whatever. You know what I'm saying?
Do you remember writing your first song straight, like as now the reborn version of you now? Or reborn.
There was a couple that I wrote straight while, like, you know, because I would have brief stints of
surprise. That's what I mean.
I wrote a detox and shit. I wrote one called Black Horses that was on World with No Skies. I wrote that sober. And that shit is still to this day, like it's dark and it's dope. Awesome. So I think a lot of it's a lie. You know what I'm saying? That I need. Because we like to get into these little rhythms and we have a process, and I like to set the temperature to the same degrees in the room every time. And how I do that is by I know if I'm too bombed, I'm going to be sloppy, but I like to be right in the perfect zone. The same thing with going on stage. Like I know I can drink this much and then I can drink while I'm on stage. But then after stage is when I really get fucked up. But I need to get like a nice buzz just so I can wild out. You know what I'm saying? So that was a big adjustment when I got sober, man. Like, especially performing live. Like, at least in the studio, if that voice is too loud and telling me the song sucks, like I can leave the studio. But when I'm on stage and I'm looking and everybody's looking at me, and it's like brand new because I never performed sober before. That was a difficult thing to overcome.
Yeah. I've done that mistake going out too blasted for my own good, and then realize like, yo, hold on, I don't know this shit. I barely know that. I barely remember these fucking things. Get fuck out of here, crazy. And let me ask you this: so when you, all right, I remember. All right, so I remember you doing the whole the open mics, and when you were in New York bouncing, and then I remember kind of the early connecting the dots with the House of Pain and all that. How did the official getting up with the House of Pain thing become? Because then that led into the La Coca stuff.
It evolved over time. You know what I'm saying? It's like anything, you know what I'm saying? That happens authentically and organically. Like it takes time. So like the first time I met Danny Boy was also at CBGB's in like 1999 or something like that. And it was just in passing. I met him through Caves from Lords of Brooklyn. I think Lords of Brooklyn did a show at CB's. And I met Danny. And then a few years later, I reached out to Danny because I was doing like I was recording a record with the label with the dude that I started a record label with that didn't end up working out. But we flew Danny into Boston, and you know that was another part. And then a year later, when I flew out to LA or whatever, I linked up with Danny, and then Danny plugged me in with Lethal, and then Lethal signed me to a pre-production deal. And then, you know, over the course of time, it just ended up evolving into that. Like, La Coca didn't really start as what it ended up as. It started as Lethal signed me to a pre-production deal. He signed Lefty to a pre-production deal. He signed this other kid, Opto, to a pre-production deal. And he didn't feel like doing 3 different tapes for three different kids. So he had us all get in the studio together and we started working. And then Danny Boy drew up a logo and then, you know, that shit didn't work. It didn't work out. Like, we recorded 18 songs. It kind of fell by the wayside. I went back to Boston. And then when I went back out there again, that's kind of when Everlast came back into the fray, and he recorded a song with me, and then Bill was coming out, and then that's when it all started to come together like that. So it took about 5 years after the first time I met Danny before that happened.
And then how was that then? All right, you've recorded with Everlast in the you've done sessions with him together in the studio.
So when I first went out, it was after I had worked with Lethal the first time. I went back out there and Lethal produced a song, and I reached out to Everlast and asked him to be on it. And then we ended up House of Pain had broken up like 10 years before that. So we all went out to dinner, and that was the first time the three of them had been like at the table together since they broke up, I guess. That's right. Crazy. So and we ended up kicking it, and Everlast came back to the studio, and he laid a verse on this song. I forget the name of the song. I think it's When the Sky Falls or something. I forget the name of the song, but it ended up in Gone Baby Gone. See, after that happened, like, things started to really escalate quickly. So, you know, like, you met me in 96, right? So there was 10 years before 2006 where it was like all these kind of pieces coming together and developing my style and all that. So once I got to 2006 and Lococa got together in the form that it event, you know, with Danny Boy, Lethal, Everlast, Ill Bill, myself, and Lefty. And then the Boston Herald did a story about that. And Ben Affleck saw me in the Herald and then called me in for an audition. And then it was once 2006 came, then things started to just go like that.
That was it. You graduated. That's when you graduated, and then it was on. You had to get, you know, like, okay, because all that shit. So that's just what I was going to go into. I was wondering where on the timeline was Lococa, and then that when Ben Affleck found you. And so it was around that same time that shit all happened.
Same time. So, bro, like, the kid, there was a dude who I was starting a label with, and we got like this warehouse in Roxbury, and which is a neighborhood in Boston, and we were putting a studio in there, and we were trying to set it all up, and he ended up getting popped, and he had a case and everything, and he fell out of the picture. So I'm in this warehouse for like 8 months. There's no hot water, there's no electricity, everything's getting shut off, and I'm just like squatting in there. I had nowhere else to go, and I'm trying to make shit happen. And that's when I'm going back and forth, you know, Lethal's flying me out to LA, I'm crashing on Danny's couch, the beginning of the coke has happened, I'm flying back to Boston and squatting in that spot. And that's when Affleck seen me in the paper. The Herald did a story. You know, at the same time, I got my first mixtape out that's really fucking buzzing in Boston. Like, I'm starting to get known, but I'm not really making money yet, seriously. You know what I'm saying? So I'm just like doing everything I can to hold it all together. And that's when Affleck saw me in the newspaper. So I went in there and I auditioned for that. I ended up auditioning like 5 times, but.
All right. Let me ask you this though. How he gets in contact with you? How does he find you? Or do you go
here's how the story goes. So because I had no electricity at the spot, and because I was blank and did coke, I was up the spot at the after hours. And I would charge my phone there and I would hang there till like 7 a.m. Then I'd go back and I would crash out. Now there's an area right up the street from there, Mass Ave area, called Methadone Mile in Boston. And I walked up to the mobile gas station there, and I knew I was in the Herald that day. This dude, Chris Ferrone, wrote a story. It was about, I had this new single coming out, and it was about House of Pain getting back together and Nonfiction and Lords of Brooklyn and everybody being involved in like this kind of collaborative group. But it was a little bit of my backstory about my shit, about Lococa, and had my picture in it. So when I went back and I crashed out, I woke up at 3 p.m. and I had all these missed phone calls, like 60 something missed phone calls. And, you know, a lot of them was people just saying they see me in the newspaper that knew me or whatever, but it was also Affleck. Beck and his people in the casting agency, and they reached out to the Herald, and they reached out to 94.5, and they reached. So I had all these media outlets calling me, and so eventually I called the casting agency, and they're like, "Can you come in today?" And I was like, I was banged up. I was like, "Tomorrow, I'll come in tomorrow." So I got good and drunk, and I went in there and I auditioned. And
but let me ask you this: when you first hear like, "Oh, whatever, we're casting Ben Affleck for a movie," what are you thinking? Are you thinking it's bullshit? How many times did you have to hear it to be like, wait a minute, is this shit real or not? Or did you believe it from jump? Like, wait a minute.
I did, but you know what's crazy is I had heard already that they had a couple other white rappers come in, dudes that I knew. I think Bill might have auditioned for it.
Gotcha.
I think that's what Derek did. But there was other dude, because the original role that he had me read for was not the one that I got. It was the role of Cheese. And in the book, Cheese is like this big, like, this white dude who talks like a black dude or whatever, right? Mm-hmm. And so that's, he was having all these white rappers come in for that role, and that's what he had me come in for. That's what I auditioned for the first two times I went in. And then they hit me and said, we think you would be better for this role of Bubba Rogowski. Will you come and read for this? So I read for that three times. And then, I got it.
And let me ask you this, was he there for all the readings?
He was. Oh, and then he was instructing me towards the end, because like I never did that before, you know. So he told me, I think the last one, he was like, you know, I really want you for this role. I need you to put this onto the tape. And I forget, you know, it was the way he wanted it, because he,
gotcha.
In hindsight, he was pitching me to the studio, you know.
Yeah, he was looking out for you, trying to tell you what you.
Yeah,
gotcha.
Also, like, he had a vision for that in retrospect. Like, he put a lot of like really authentic Boston people who didn't have acting experience. So when you're talking to a major studio and they're like, wait a minute, who the fuck are you putting in this movie? You know, yeah. I'm guessing on that end of it. So
yeah,
he had to really sell his vision for like getting me into that role or getting other people into these roles. And I'll tell you what, like that movie is great because of that. It's the most authentic Boston movie ever.
It is. That shit, everybody feels like dudes that, it feels like when I go to Fenway, which the whole, that's like the same people there that I've seen when I've played fucking the club across the street. Like, it really feels like that. The whole movie feels like that. You know what I mean? Mm. That's what I said. What I liked about him was like he made a city movie and he tried to keep the city involved. You know what I mean? Yeah. That's dope, because some people do just enough to keep the city, you know, happy, but you could tell he's making Boston movie. He's trying to make that shit Boston. You know what I mean?
Like, yeah, and he's just a phenomenal director, man.
Yeah, he killed it.
Like, he's made some great movies. You know, after that, he did The Town, obviously. But he also, the one that got the best picture was the political one. I'm drawing. I can't believe I'm drawing a blank.
Great. And what was the, you were doing a movie recently when I talked to you, right? You were doing some southern, you were doing some southern shit, right? Or something, right?
Yeah,
down south or something.
Yeah, it comes out in November. So it's called Ida Red. It's with Frank Grillo, it's with Josh Hartnett, Melissa Leo, and William Forsythe, who, if you, he's
hard. William Forsythe, the hard.
Oh, he's great, man. And I got.
How is he? So you worked with him? Were you able to work with him? I mean, like, same set? Like, when he's there?
Hold on. Argo is the movie I was talking about that Ben directed, that one best.
Argo, picture. Yeah, that shit was Argo, huge. Yeah. Forget it. It was huge.
But, so Forsythe. So basically, I got called up during the pandemic. This dude, John Swab, he directed a couple movies that I was in. He did one called Let Me Make You a Martyr with Marilyn Manson in it. And he shot it on like a shoestring budget. It was his first film. But I could see that he was really talented. I saw a short that he did. And then I went back down there. He shoots his movies in Tulsa, Oklahoma, where he's from. I went back down there in 2018 and did a movie called Run with the Hunted with him. And then he called me in the beginning of the pandemic and was like, yo, I'm shooting a movie. I was like, right now you are? You know what I'm saying? Nobody's shooting shit. Like, it was like,
not yet.
In the height of the pandemic, he's like, yeah, he's like, you know, we got restrictions. Everyone got to wear masks. You got to quarantine in your hotel room when you're not shooting, you know, all. And I was like, all right, I'm in, you know what I'm saying? And I play a Southern cop. like a family man. It's totally against anything I've ever done. Like
you're like a family man, totally everything I've
ever done. It's great, you know what I'm saying? Because like I'm used to playing like, you know, like a certain type. And a lot of times I got the Boston accent. I'm like a Boston criminal. And as an actor, like obviously you want to have a range of shit you could do. But, you know, some of these casting types aren't the most imaginative people, believe it or not. You know what I'm saying? And they just want you for that and not for this. So,
yeah,
you know, I've been doing like dialect coaching and stuff like that for a few years now. But this one, I really get a chance to do like the accent. And Forsyth is my partner in this. Like, he's a federal agent that comes in to investigate Hartnett and Grillo, who are these, they do heists and stuff like that. And their mother is the matriarch of a crime family, and she's in jail and she's dying of cancer. They're trying to get her out of prison. But meanwhile, I'm married to Josh Hartnett's sister and I'm kind of pursuing the case. So I have to try to lock him up. And I get to work with Forsyth, man, and he's kind of like my mentor in the movie. And it was just an interesting dynamic to it because, you know, Offset, we're hanging every day. You know, like I said, we're in this bubble of the pandemic, so you can't really hang with too many people.
How was he? Like, let me ask you, did you learn off of him?
I learned a lot, man. I would talk to him every day. I watched the way he prepared. We would rehearse our scenes together, and just the level of preparation that he put in every day, I was like, wow. Because, you know, for most of the early stuff I did, especially, like, I was just flying by the seat of my pants and just be like, all right, I know this. I know, like, you know, I started off with Gone Baby Gone in the Town. It was like, I grew up around people like this. I know what this is. Like,
yeah,
you know what I'm saying? Like, it's right in my wheelhouse. I know exactly the way they would say it, how they would do it.
All yeah.
It. Like, and that's what Ben wanted me to bring to that role. That's great. But now it's like, I got to learn how to walk in
some other
the
shoes shit.
Of these this dude from Oklahoma and to talk like him and to think like him and to move like him and all that. And to watch the level of commitment that Forsyth has to it and how much experience he has doing this and all the greats that he's worked with. And now, I mean, dude, the best education I ever got with this shit has been the people I work with. Like, I've gotten to work with everybody from Affleck and Renner to Brad Pitt and fucking Leota and, you know, Forsyth. And, you know, it's just like,
hell yeah, that's the way you learn.
Yeah, that's it. You keep your ears open and just shut the fuck up and listen, man. That's it. You know what I'm saying? Like,
you know, Forsyth was on Chips back on the day. He played a skinhead on Chips.
Did he?
Yeah. How ill is that? If people out there go fucking Google that shit. And I remember bugging out with my brother again. My brother put me on everything. Rest in peace. He would be like, yo, check it out. It was on like Slam Dancing. It was like new wave against punk rock, and William Forsyth was the main bad guy in that shit. Yeah. But he was always our favorite.
But he was in Once Upon a Time in America too, bro.
American Me. You kidding me? Yeah. That was fucking Once Upon a Kaka. He was great. He has that face and just that whole. He's even great in like comedies. I've seen him in all types of shit.
Yeah,
you know what I mean, he's
phenomenal, and he's a great guy too. He was awesome to work with, man.
And how long was that movie to do?
That was a month, and we had to get the test, you know, the nasal tests every other day. You know, like when I wasn't shooting, I was in my hotel room. I was like fucking binge watching Netflix shit with my girlfriend while she was in Boston. Like, we would watch the same shit at the same time. And then in between that, when I was prepping for, you know, the scene the next day, I was working with the dialect coach. When I would go out to eat, because Danny Boy lives down there too, so I would link up with Danny and we'd go out to eat, and I would talk in the accent. I would order my food in the accent, you know what I'm saying? And just
let me ask that thing. Because I heard you on Richie and Joe's podcast. I think that's where you talked about where I heard you talking about the dialect shit. Let me ask you this with the dialect shit. So what's a quick little thing that you found how to speak like a hick? Oh, excuse me, like a southerner, you know, whatever you want to call it. Like, you know, you must have found some couple little, you know, sweet spots for certain words that, you know, like, you know.
Yeah, you know what's crazy is, like, I could do the accent if I had, like, to get in the role, like, I really have to be in it to do it the right way. And like,
yeah, because you got it, like,
that's why I had to go out and order shit in that accent. Like, I would talk to people on the phone in the accent, And it's because, like, I'm afraid, like, if I get out of it, then I'm going to slip when I'm on the screen. It's terrifying.
Yeah, man. Hell yeah.
You get on there and you're like, oh, fuck. Like, people are going to know I'm lying. You know what I'm saying? Like,
who did you, was there any specific person or movie that you watched to be like, let me follow this, that you were kind of like?
No. So here's what and you know, like, I never went to any acting school or classes until recently, like about 3 years ago, I started going, and I unlearned some things that I had learned. And I'll tell you, I used to memorize my lines by listening, because I'm an audio listener. I'm used to memorizing my songs by listening to them so I could go out on stage and do them. And I learned that's actually a really bad thing to do with acting. Oh, because once your brain memorizes the rhythm of how you say it, you can't do it any other way.
The fluctuations on the words.
Then if you have to change it, then you will forget the lines. So I learned a different way to memorize. I also learned, like, never to imitate anybody else or watch the way I do shit in the mirror, to just live and breathe in that character's skin. So the way that I did the dialect stuff was, I work with the dialect coach, and she goes right down into you, the use of your diaphragm, the muscles in your tongue and your jaw and your mouth. And I started working out all those. So I do like an hour vocal warm up with her. And I actually started doing it, like, when I went on tour with her, to warm up my voice and stuff like that. Cause sometimes I'll blow out my voice at the beginning of a tour.
Yeah.
Once I get used, once I'm like three shows in, I'm good for 20 shows. But like the where I'm in danger with my voice, always like shocking it the first.
Yeah, the first, yeah.
But yeah. So anyways, it's all connected. So she basically taught me how to use my mouth, how to use all the muscles in my mouth, because when you talk with a Boston accent, you're not using certain parts of your tongue and your mouth, and you're like, yeah, I parked a car over there, it's a lazy way to talk, like, yeah. That, you know. So just by doing all that work over the years, like, my Boston accent's kind of like been dialed down, man, and like, not intentionally, but, you know.
Let me ask you, do you know where the boss, that heavy Boston accent came? Obviously it's a Southie, but way, obviously an Irish, but do you think it's from old school Irish coming to New America, learning English, and that was some of their accents?
I think there's part of it. It's crazy. She knows, this woman's name is Jameson Bryant. She's brilliant. She works with like a lot of different, she's on movie sets all the time. Like, sometimes I'll hit her up, I'll be in Europe, and I'm like, hey, can you jump on for a vocal exercise? Yeah. And she's like, oh, I'm on set, you know what I mean? Like, she's worked steady, but she knows the history of all of it. But yeah, I think it comes from that. It also comes from, like we say, with the music and the film, right? You're a product of the time, right? And that's how these accents, people talk based on like the whole culture around them. So down south, it's slower, and they talk,
true,
they talk a little slower like this, and you know what I'm saying? And
yeah.
But up here, and then in New York, where people are like more boisterous, there's more people, you have to be louder to be heard. Sure. And, you know, very outward with the
projection. Yeah, you project. Yeah, no, it makes sense.
So
because, you know why I say that? Because, so, you know, obviously we all spend a lot of time in Europe, and, you know, and my son, my wife, rest in peace, was half Dutch. She was Dutch. So my son's half Dutch, and I grew up, you know, and I've been around the Dutch forever. And the crazy thing is, when they learn how to speak English good, they sound like, not that they have a New York accent, but it kind of sounds, it sounds like a New York accent without the slang overtone on it. You know what I mean? It's crazy. And the Dutch are a big part of the, you know, the early New York fucking language. It's mad crazy. I hear it when all my friends from Holland and Belgium learn English, it sounds like a Northeast English. It's fucking crazy. And it makes sense because they're the ones who came in and fucking invaded our fucking natives.
Well, yo, it's all those things. So that's kind of like what turns me on with acting now, is that part of it where it's like, you know, fucking all these things make up a human being, and how they talk and how they act and how they dress and how they move and all that. There's so many elements to it. So to really get into somebody's skin and play a role like that, you have to know all that shit. You have to know, like, what kind of sneakers do they wear? Yeah. I used to think in the beginning, like, when the first couple of things I did, like, because it was so natural to me to play those early roles, like, I was, and I would see people, like, doing all that extra shit, I was like, ah, that's just some
fantasy, right?
Yeah. But nah, it really is. Like, what kind of sneakers they wear? What time does this guy wake up? What are his values? What makes him angry? You know what I'm saying? Like, all that shit. Because you have to be able to react in the moment. You have to live in that person's skin. It's kind of like, it's a cool thing. You know what I'm saying?
Yeah, yeah, no. But right now, you saying it like that, I never thought about it like that. But it makes it more interesting when you want to, like, say, okay, let me dig into a character. Okay, now that's digging in. Like, yeah. Okay, because it's true what you were. If you're a construction worker, if you're a 9 to 5, okay, you wear boots. You're wearing boots, okay? The guy's, you know, 9 to 5 working Joe. Okay, how he's going to be? He's going to be grumpy. It might be like this. It makes sense how you could start molding a character thinking about how would he dress.
Is it the type of dude that would spit while he's walking down the street? You know what I'm saying? Because some people would never do that.
Yeah, I know. It's fucking, that's dope. And that was I remember we were talking about that. And was that the last thing you did?
Yeah, that was the last thing I did. So, and that was kind of some of that stuff I got by watching Forsythe too. I see he does that. Yeah. You know what I'm saying? He's very much into like what kind of watch this guy would wear. What kind of, you know what I'm saying? Like what kind of hat? What kind of boots? No, they have to be this kind of boots. He was like very specific about all that shit. And if he couldn't get it the way he wanted to, like he didn't like that. You know what I'm saying?
That's great. You know how that is when you're writing one of your songs, you know, it got to be how you want it. I'm fucking anal like that too. You know, I'm like, I get it. And but that's dope because that means you're putting in, you know, you could tell when you put in time into something, you know what I mean? Or when some shit's just thrown together.
Yeah, you know what I mean? When you give a fuck about it.
Yeah, you could tell when you put that love that's like, you know, that you put that soul food in whatever it is that you do, you could tell. You know what I mean? And all that shit and fucking. And now what's next with the movies?
I got a couple of things. Like I wrote one that I'm trying to get made. And
you were telling me.
And another friend of mine wrote one that he wrote a really dope role that I want to play in it. So I'm trying to, I started looking at it different, man. Cause for a while, you know, for a decade, I was living in LA and Boston. So like bring it back to the pandemic, chasing the bag around the world, touring. I'm living in LA half the time. I'll do 2 weeks in LA, 2 weeks in Boston. I'm trying to get back for my son's game, then go out in LA so I could be there for auditions and all that. And when the pandemic came, that stopped. And I had kind of a moment of clarity with that shit where I was like, the fuck am I chasing auditions for? Nothing I ever got came from like standing in a line or going in for it. Always came organically. Like I got the call out of the newspaper or they reached out to me for this. Or they liked me for this one. That's the way it fucking works anyways. So I was like, you know what? I never did that with music. I never fucking was like, sign me. Maybe in the very beginning, but like after that, I was like, yo, I'm just going to make records, find my own fan base.
Make noise.
That. So, what I realized in the pandemic was I like being at home with my son and my family and my girl and her kids who live with me. And I like that. I love acting, but I don't chase nothing. You know what I'm saying? And I love making music, but I don't fucking chase nothing with that neither. Like I'm just, so I'm in this new spot right now where it's like, I'm 43 years old. I have, you know, I have a fan base that I'm very appreciative of. And I have a skill set that I love to use. But I'm also not chasing shit and I'm not thirsty for nothing. And I don't need nobody to put me on with nothing. I want to make the shit that I want to make. And I'm going to try to take the same approach with films as I did with music, where I'm just going to try to make my own shit and find a fan base with it. And then whatever happens, happens. Whatever the universe sees fit, then I'm cool with. You know what I'm saying?
Yeah, that's the day and age now is doing it. Like you could do it now. You know, now that's how it is. That whole DIY is what's in style now, like something that how we came up with that mentality. Like, you know, people forget this. This is why I love this hardcore shit. You know why? Because it's the whole, there's no other scene where you had some 15-year-old kid finding a venue, renting it out, booking the bands, you know, no other scene. I don't give a fuck what it is. I don't, because even if it was a hip hop show, it's at the roller skating ring. It's at this and that. It's already at an established thing. It's at a big part. This was like young kids in this punk rock hardcore shit that were doing. Yo, they loved it so much and they had nowhere to do it. So they like early hip hop. We got to make this up. We OK, an abandoned building. Well, that's our club. OK, We're going to need somebody at the door. Yo, you're my biggest friend. All right, you're the doorman. You know, you made it happen. That's what I loved it. And everybody was 15, 16. Look at the 15-year-olds now. Yeah, these motherfuckers don't know how to do shit. You know, it's crazy. It's crazy. Try to tell them how to put use a tape player. They'll look at you with like 10 heads. You know, it's so crazy how it is now.
Bro, it's the best way to do it, man. Like, looking for somebody to put you on, man. That's like, you know, or like, you know, the thing that I had to ask myself, and part of this was like, you know, I started clearing up and my values started changing once I got sober. After a while, like, it was difficult to create in the beginning. I went through all these different phases, yeah. But like what I want out of life became more apparent to me over the last few years. And one of those things is like, yo, I just want to be able to show up for my son and be there. Like, that's my number one priority. Yep. Chasing something in fucking Hollywood. Fuck all that. You know what I'm saying? Like, so that kind of, but it's also what I was saying, where it's like anything that was meant for me always came to me anyway. So like, I'm just going to do what I love to do, what I know how to do. And whoever fucks with me, cool. And if you don't fuck with me, cool. I don't care.
And that's the best way to be. That's how I am. You know, exactly. We just do what we do as good as we could do it and hope people get it. You know what I mean? I tell people that. Let me tell you this, right? Let me ask you this right now. And I know it's hard to pin down because we could go into errors and whatever. Remember this. I know this and I know you. But right now, gun in your head, you have to put a fucking Mount Everest of rap. Four guys, even if it's a team, a duet, they count as one. You know, you don't got to use them as two. You know what I mean?
But like, four is too hard, man. I mean,
you know,
like,
I know it's hard, but like this, you only could pick four to put on. Right now, we got a brand new kid. This kid is brand new. This kid's going to be great at whatever we implant in his head. Right. This kid, whatever. He's a blank thing. And they go, OK, we're going to get to make this kid the ultimate rap kid. But we only got four ingredients of rap that we could put in him.
Oh, man.
You have to put these four ingredients in. And there's four groups for four individuals. It don't matter. I know there's more. We probably would have 10 to 15 if we had a pin down.
Well, I think here's the distinction. So whenever I make a top 10 list, right, mine is a little bit different than other people. But what I base it on is a few different things, like obviously like skill and like mic presence. You know what I'm saying? Because like we know like a Biggie Smalls or an Ice Cube's mic presence goes beyond what their technical words. Yes. Wordplay is, right? So like I know that Ice Cube and Biggie don't have the technical wordplay of Kool G Rap or Eminem, but their mic presence is just so great, and it's like an intangible quality.
Exactly.
But I also, you also, and this is the part that a lot of people leave out, and this is an important part, whether this is in there or not, but impact. Do we include impact on this Mount Everest? Because impact to me is like, if you're including impact, then there's no way that you can leave out Tupac. There's no way that, you know, because his impact, I might not think Tupac was one of the greatest 10 or four artists ever, but his impact was
yes.
Number one.
Yeah, and I agree. And this is why I said this. If you had only four to give, and that's what I mean. Out of these four, you might have to pick one who was the impact guy, one who was the lyrical guy, one who was the whatever. That's what I was saying. So you had to pick four, and you're the representative for hip hop. So everybody's like, Slane, who are the fucking four or five or whatever that you, no more than five. If you had to give some kid that, okay, you're like, okay, it goes deeper than that, but I'm going to give you a good five, a good batch of five to start your fucking. Yeah, hip hop rap fucking experience.
Are we including producers too?
No, rappers. If they happen to rap, but like again, like how you said, and however you want to put it, if the you know the impact guy, the delivery, you got five guys. You pick five.
Well, you know, I got, you know, in my, this is kind of my wild card. Most people don't include them, but I think Ice Cube has got to be in there.
Oh, I agree.
Ice Cube, like I said, his mic presence, he dominated an era from 1988 to he kind of was at the forefront of the West Coast.
So dope.
Hip hop. And also he wrote arguably one of the greatest hip hop and you know, and Straight Outta Compton, he wrote one of the greatest records ever. He also, you know, that solo record run that he went on with America's Most Wanted. That's a good kid. And you know what I'm saying?
All that
Predator,
shit.
All that shit. Oh my God. I mean, bro, he just has so many classics. And then, you know, obviously transitioned, especially his early shit acting, the Boys in the Hood shit.
Yeah, oh, he surpassed, yep.
He was great. So I put him up there.
Now, remember, this is a young kid, so you got him for that. All right. All right, you got the Ice Cube, and Ice Cube is nice.
I also got to put Jay-Z in there, and I'll tell you why. Jay-Z is the story of hip-hop from beginning to end, right? So you're talking about, like, the great American rags to riches story. You're talking about the drug dealer who didn't pay the consequence at the end.
Yeah.
You know what I'm saying? Who transitioned it successfully, who didn't end up dead or in jail, who actually ended up, like, Wall Street. He went from Rossi Projects to the boardroom, you know what I'm saying, to be a billionaire.
Board of directors and shit.
And he's had, I mean, like, when you want to talk about impact with Jay-Z, just all those hit records, all the hit singles, all, you know, the fashion sense, the ability to be a spokesman for the culture, where you can sit down on CNN and talk about hip hop to America. You know what I'm saying? Like, to me, that has a value where maybe he's, and he is a great MC too. Maybe, you know, there's other people that might be able to rap technically better than him, but they don't have that whole package. You know what I'm saying? The business
for sense, sure.
Story, the mouthpiece.
For sure. He ain't one of my favorites, but he belongs there. Like, I agree, because that dude's on some other shit. Like, he's nice in every way. And he, you know, he knows how to talk. He has his records clean, you know, and everything. You know, the hood loves him. The clubs love him. He does something for the girls. You know, he does something for the animals. He got, you know.
And he stayed current over the two decades, you know.
Yeah.
Let's see. So Ice Cube, Jay.
And those are two, of course.
I don't know if he belongs in the top four, but I always put him in my top 10 MCs, and that's Prodigy, because he had a poetry to him that, like, I love, like, his vocal tone, but he would say things in a way that nobody else said them. And even though it seems simple, it wasn't. It was complex, like, in the way that he put it. At the same time, over the Mobb Deep production with that, you know, it was quintessential New York shit.
Yeah.
I love Prodigy too, you know. Shit. I mean, you know, I think this is why it's so hard to do four, because you can't really ignore, like, so the early contributions, like the Melly Mel's or the,
of course,
you know, Rakim, who kind of innovated a whole style, and, you know, there's just, but then I think G Rap too, like how he kind of innovated that multi-syllabic wordplay shit has become
and that's what I mean, but that's why I wanted that, because not for exactly to match up your top four or five, but for those reasons exactly, why would you pick each one? Because they all bring something to the, that's what it should be on a Mount Rushmore. What does it bring? You know, like, and I agree, because, you know, like I grew up with G-Rap. He grew up in my neighborhood. You know, he's from Corona. And I remember being a little kid. Polo was the custodian at my elementary school. So when you went to throw out the garbage from lunchtime, Polo was the garbage man there. But, like, he was already, they dropped it to demo. So he already had gold. He had a Benz. And I remember, you know, all the girls loved him. And he was mad cool. Polo was mad cool. And we were like, yo, somebody from the hood made it. You know, we were like, yo, this is crazy. And I was like, but, you know, G-Rap was known for, like, when I was a kid, I remember the big thing was like, yo, G-Rap versus Kane. And because they were like the real lyrical dudes. And then you had Biz. Biz was a party guy. If you wanted to party, that was the guy you went to. So I always understood who was for what, you know what I mean? Like, and then when I got older, I like picking dudes' brains on who they thought what. Cause, like, let me tell you,
I'm gonna leave Prodigy out then, and what I'm gonna replace. So I'm gonna do Ice Cube and Jay for different reasons. But then, you know, I was thinking Cypress Hill, but then I thought because of their live performance. But then I have to go to the root of the inspiration for Cypress Hill, And I think those guys have set a public. I mean, Cypress Hill is my favorite group to perform live. Yeah, I love those guys. They're tremendous guys. I love Be Real. I love Sandlot. I love
and live. Them. They're the best there.
And they're just incredible. And they made such just like, you know, their whole movement and their sound was just so original. But, and I've heard them say it, it was the inverse of another group that inspired them. That you had the deep baritone for the front man and you had the high pitch shit for the hype man, and that's Public Enemy. Wow. So even though Public Enemy probably isn't like one of my personal favorite top 10, I think they're so relevant and important in hip hop music. So I think like their live show, what they represented, the political movement behind it at the time that they did it too, like that really exploded that, that like really, that thing that's kind of missing in hip hop now too. Like it's that revolutionary aspect to hip hop music where it's like, you know, I think they called it like back in the day, the Black CNN. This is like, you know, and just the style, which what they did it with and the
of music. Course they had, there was a cause for a lot of that shit. Now people, there's no cause for nothing. You know what I mean? Everybody's just comfortable being a moron. You know what I mean? That's what, right now, if you had, all right, what would you tell anybody, any new kid right now? All right, right now, you got your chance to tell any new kid coming up, a new kid, he wants to rap, whatever. What advice could you give him right now to that dude, you know the lay of the land right now, what it is. What advice would you give a new kid right now?
I mean, I think it's basically what we were talking about. So I think about it, what would I tell the 14-year-old version of myself? And I would tell them, like, it ain't about just getting on or, like, making noise or getting everybody to stream your shit or making a lot of money, any of that. Like, ultimately, it's, like, and this is what kind of I've repositioned in my life. Forget about what the music can give me. Like, I try to think what I can give to it.
Yeah.
Like, when I, like, can I tell the truth about what's going on in my life or in the world or in this situation, in this song? And if I can cut to the truth of it and portray that and make something great around that, that's all I give a fuck now about now. And then the rest of that shit will come if you do that effectively. But you can't look at it as like a means to justify an end. Like, I want to be platinum. I want to be I want these things. Like, that has nothing to do with the music. You know what I'm saying? If you make music that's based on the reality of your life, of the world around you and everything, and the truth of that, then that music becomes timeless. If you do it well, you know what I'm saying? Then that music becomes timeless.
Exactly.
You know, Madball might have fans that aren't even born yet. Same with me. Like, my music could be more relevant 20 years from now than it is now.
For sure.
It's the truth. You know what I'm saying?
Yeah,
and that's more important than like whether or not Hoya or Slane made $10 million in fucking 2023. You know what I'm saying?
Exactly. Exactly. My whole shit is when we go out, that people go out saying, yo, those motherfuckers lived that shit. They, you know, they walked what they talked. You know, if it was, or they walked it how they talked it back then, and whatever it is, they always stood, you know, on track. You know, when we do music, it's our soul out there. And I want to keep continuing doing that and keeping the music pure and trying to keep the, not just our movement, just everything pure and moving forward. You know what's up, Slane? Like I said, I'm glad I got you on here because I know times are crazy and also with you, I'm glad that you've been grinding. You're one of the guys who we have a lot of friends that could be falling off the edge at any minute now. And I'm glad that you're one of the dudes that you worked at it, but you finally, you know, you caught you dug your hooks in. And you know, I feel already be like, oh no, he's done with it. Cause you know, even with me being, I got a lot of people that we know. They try and they meant well. And not that saying that's an easy thing to do because it's not. But I'm glad that you're one of the guys who worked that shit and it worked in the positive. And you were your, I know that shit helped you out with your kid. And I see you. I know that kept you more, it helped you be focused during this time right now because it helped me stay focused. You know, you know how it is during wartime, you got to be focused. So it's good that we have our senses you know, sharp. So, you know.
Yo, yeah. And it's like, you know, and this relates to all of it, but like nobody does, when you talk about music, like nobody continues to make music at the level we're at this far into their lives unless they fucking love it and they're the truth with it. You know what I'm saying?
Facts.
Like, we live this, we walk this, we rep this. This is part of who we are outside of any fucking show or tours or labels or money or record sales or anything. This is just part of who we are and what we do. And as far as like, that's been a part of like rebuilding my life in every facet. You know what I'm saying? So like wherever I go, all that shit comes with me. The music comes with me, whatever my growth is or whatever, you know, any difficulties, hardships, like that shit is all reflected in that. That's an outlet that I have in order to get, that gets me through.
Yeah.
You know what I'm saying? Whatever difficulties there are, whatever obstacles, whatever's going on in the world, I'm always going to use creative spirit. You know what I'm saying?
Listen, your kid looks happy, so you're killing it. You know, that's how I say to me, you know, when you have kids, that's how you could tell how good a parent is. You know, if you got happy kids, your kids look happy. And I know you're fucking grinding and I'm fucking, I know you're busy with this whole, you know, we're the dudes bobbing and weaving and surviving during these crazy times. We're not the dudes folding. So that's what I love to see when my people are grinders and all that shit. And I'm fucking, but let people know where they can find you, where they can follow you and where your music is going to drop and all that good shit. Cause we got a lot of people in Europe too, that tune into here. And I know they all love you. Cause every time I go to Europe, they would go, Slane, LaCocca, you know, fucking, and you know, sick jacket.
Shout out to Jack. Man, that's the worst thing about the pandemic is there's so many people that I love that I miss that I used to see a lot more. And,
yeah, I know.
You know. Jack is one of them. You know what I'm saying?
Hell yes. Shout out to them, all of them. Hell yeah.
Bill just sent me a joint the other day with Gore-Tex.
Dope.
I put a verse on it. Jack is putting something on it for Bill's new record. Dope. I'm working on an album with Static Selector right now.
Oh, dope. So where's that music? When that's ready to drop, where they get it at? Where you
check it out on Spotify, on Apple Music, on all the streaming sites. I have a website, SlaneOfficial.com. That's also my Facebook page, Slane Official, Slane's World on Instagram. And, my shit is just everywhere that music can be found, brother.
Hell yeah. Listen, Slaney Slane, I'm glad you were able to come on. I'm glad I grabbed you. Listen, I hope to catch you in the flesh somewhere. You know, we're going to get up soon. You know how that shit is, you know. We're going to talk. I'm going to let you know. This shit drops this Thursday, and I'm going to let you know. And I'm glad, again, mad love to you, Slaney Slane. You know what's up. Keep killing it. Kiss the fan for me. I'm going to hit you up later, and we'll talk soon, my brother.
All right, Hoya. I'll talk to you soon, bro.
Yo, one love. We out, everybody.
Hi, this is Chad Nicefield.
And this is Justin Press.
We're the host of Making Waves, the Shiprock podcast, a part of the Sound Talent Media Podcast Network. We're inviting you to sail away with us on an epic journey in musical enlightenment. Every week, we bring you only the best artists in rock music and discuss everything from the cruise to the stage to the saga of being a professional recording artist. We'll have lots of special guests along the way, so tune in every week.
Your stateroom is available every Monday morning, so welcome aboard.